we put medicine in everything, you know, traditional medicines like cedar, sage, sweetgrass, you know, those are very traditional to us, but it's also, we have people from the reservation that are beautiful foragers, and they know the medicines that are going to have so much flavor and everything. And so we're fortunate enough to be in an area with such, we have a lot of microclimates.
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat. As always, I am your co-host, Matt Miller, culture editor at onmilwaukee.com, and I am joined, as always, by Lori Frederick, dining editor at onmilwaukee.com. How are you doing today, Lori?
I'm doing well. I'm doing good. It's a Monday.
Well, which one is it, Lori? Well or good?
Well, I guess well is the most proper way of putting it. So, how about you?
I'm okay. It's a nasty Monday.
Yeah.
We are reporting from May 1st. It looks distinctly like March 1st.
Yeah, kind of like May 1st.
No, do not let the brainwashing continue.
But like,
May isn't supposed to look like this.
Well, May often looks like this. So, but yeah, it's drizzly. It's a little bit cold. The weekend looks beautiful though.
Allegedly will be great. We'll find out. Maybe summer will show up at some point.
Maybe. I hope so.
Yes. But what we do have is a wonderful guest. While we wait for wonderful weather to show up, and hopefully you're listening to this in a future where the wonderful weather has shown up, but we have a wonderful guest with us here.
We do.
Lori, would you like to introduce him?
We are here with Chef Bryce Stevenson, who is in the process of getting a really exciting project started called Majim. And I'm going to let him tell you all about that. But hi, Bryce.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for joining us. So
no,
you have to translate what you just said now.
So Anin Buju is just a very simple way to say, you know, hello in Ojibwe or Anishinaabe Mon. So yeah, it's just casual. You could just say, you know, Buju or Anin, but you know, just a very formal Anin Buju.
Anin Buju.
So. Anin Buju. Yep.
Anin Buju? Okay.
Yep, correct.
I'll have to keep that in my in my list of greetings, so that I remember. So Bryce, set the stage for us. I guess give us a brief summary of what the Majim concept is. And kind of what makes its location so special. And then we'll move along and talk a little bit about you and what you've done leading up to this.
Yeah, so Majim in Ojibwe, the word simply means food. It's just plain and simple. And that's really what this is all about. This is about taking us back to just simple food from where you're at. And so where we're opening up at is on Madeline Island. And Madeline Island is in the Apostle Islands in Lake Superior in northern Wisconsin. And I've always found that people either know it or they've just never heard of it.
Although the Apostle Islands are a fairly popular tourist destination, at least in the summer months.
Well, absolutely. So I'm from Red Cliff, which is a Ojibwe reservation here at the very tip, very northernmost tip of Wisconsin. And Bayfield is our big town right next to us. And that's the just tourist mecca of the Northwoods. You know, it's kind of you have your Door County or you have your Bayfield, and they're very similar in their fashions. But what makes the area so special really is the Apostle Islands. And those islands are a very sacred cultural center for the Ojibwe people, especially Madeline Island. That's just what you would kind of consider our cultural mecca. And fortunately, very luckily, Majim is going to be able to open on Madeline Island and be able to serve traditional indigenous food in a more modern fashion, in this very, very sacred beautiful cultural epicenter.
that is really, really remarkable. And the story kind of leading up to how this happened is pretty remarkable too, I think. Tell us about, but let's go back a little bit further, and I guess tell us about your background, your journey to food, you know, how you ended up, you know, working in the industry. And you can go as back as far as you would like.
I mean, something like this, I could go back to the very beginning. You know, it's food's always been a struggle for me and my family, in terms of not only poverty, but also finding good food. You know, so I grew up on commodities, just USDA approved canned food, everything in a can, beef, chicken, pork, anything you can imagine. And so eating fresh, real ingredients, that never happened. You know, so it was always, the struggle started young, you know, and you know, as I grew older and was able to get off the reservation and kind of taste these other ingredients, it changed everything for me. It just expanded my mind. And, you know, even at a young age, I'm playing with new ingredients that I get to find, you know, and just trying to, most of the time it's just garbage that I'd make. I just throw stuff in a pan and it's just never work out. But once in a while you get that good dish where you're just, you know, you're just so proud of yourself. So that's the start. Professionally, you know, I honestly haven't been doing this that long. When people think of a chef's career, you know, 20, 30 years, and, you know, they've got this huge pedigree behind them. I started cooking in 2016, right at the time that Hella Falafel opened up. You know, that was my first kitchen job.
So that was Hella Falafel in Milwaukee.
Yes, correct.
Kind of a sub-brand for Odd Duck, for people who are familiar.
To sidebar, you know, I did live in Milwaukee for a very long time. That's my second home. I went to UWM and graduated with a degree in, you know, creative writing and indigenous studies. And that's
is that what brought you to Milwaukee, UWM, or did you move to Milwaukee?
Moved to Milwaukee for love. Yep. My wife Jessica, who is also the general manager from Ejim, co-owner, my partner, and her mother and her stepfather are from Milwaukee, and so we ended up moving moving there to be a little bit closer to them. You know, and so it's just, and then we just, you quickly fall in love with a city like Milwaukee. I mean, there's just, it's so it's that big city, small town, all crammed into one. And, you know, so like I said, very much a second home. And truth be told, Odd Duck, you know, is really Ross and Melissa are responsible for a lot of things for, you know, that I'm very thankful for. But that was the first place I ever ate that just had incredible food, that was creative and just different flavors. And, you know, just this, the whole atmosphere, we fell in love with it. You know, it was just kind of a random walk in and, you know, see what it's like. And we just fell in love with it so much that, as I was navigating through my sort of career options and found Hella Falafel opening, you know, I saw that is like, hey, I don't have any experience, but maybe if I get into Hella Falafel and kind of build some experience, I might get into Odd Duck and be able to, you know, work in a place that serve this food that kind of opened my mind to what food could be, you know. And fortunately, that's exactly what happened. You know, I was lucky enough, you know, I weaseled my way in to over there. So that's really my start. It was just this, I had a curiosity and started getting around people who were so passionate and so, you know, while they're serious at the same time, they keep food at an approachable, accessible level, you know. And it just I mean, there was just sparks flying in my mind, and, you know, there's all these thoughts of like, you know, like I grew up with all this crappy food. What if I had this good food growing up? And, you know, what would it have been like? What would things be like on the reservation? And, you know, and so that's really, I started connecting those dots together. You know, like I could use food as a medium to try to bring people together and sort of repair some of the very traumatic history that we have, you know. So so that's where the dream, that's where the whole, you know, one day I'm gonna do this kind of started. So
yeah, probably got you thinking. And obviously your studies at UWM were part of what kind of reconnected you in a different way to your background and your culture.
Absolutely. True? Yeah, absolutely. The boarding school system that has been in the news as of late, you know, all these tragedies with the murdered children, and but the whole purpose of those systems is to erase the culture. You know, it's the you know, you got to kill the Indian to save the child. You know, was the philosophy. And as a result of that, my grandma, her parents refused to teach them anything, and they had a very violent approach to reprimanding them if they were caught, you know, learning any language, if they were caught, you know, practicing any ceremonies. And so the phrase, you know, that they were told is you will be raised white. You know, you're white now. You're going to be raised white, you know. So.
And was the motivation behind that just to keep people safe, to sort of just blend in?
Absolutely.
You
know, I mean,
or was there something something more to that?
It's you know, assimilation. They knew that the only way they were going to have some kind of successful life is if they were to erase the indigenous spirit inside of them. And it works. I mean, my grandma absolutely, she refuses to talk about it. She refuses to, you know, acknowledge that she knows anything. The same thing with my great aunt. My great aunt Gloria, she collects things. She collects native artifacts, and, you know, just, you know, friends make something for her, and it's displayed proudly all over her walls. But when you try to ask questions or kind of get any insight about her experience, it's just a brick wall. There's just nothing there. And, you know, and that's just from generations of trauma. They don't want to share anything. And, you know, so my mom never learned anything, and we never learned anything. You know, we growing up, we just knew that we were native, but we didn't have any idea what that meant. So that just meant we were native and different, you know. And that's just kind of how I looked at it, and, you know, lived. That's the way I lived, you know, up until UWM, you know, and actually getting around other natives who think differently. They don't think in that just forget it all. They think of, you know, how can we share the culture? How can we open people's eyes? How can we open their hearts to really get back in touch with this unbelievable, beautiful culture that is just trying to be systematically erased, you know? And so it's just there's so many levels, you know, you can dig and dig and dig, and, you know, so many levels on why, you know, I had to, you know, find strangers to learn about my own people, you know. It's so
another friend of mine, I think, described it as like a culture that hasn't been lost, but that has been buried under, you know, decades of shame, just, you know, in general, that people were just made to feel ashamed of who they were, you know. And that's really, really, you know, when we talk about that, I mean, that's part of the, I think, one of the strongest pieces of violence, you know, against any culture is, you know, to force people to reject who they are you know, and who, you know, who their ancestors were.
Yeah, absolutely. And even when you do that, if you allow yourself to try to erase that, you know, it'll never truly go away. It's always in there, but that's just going to become pain when you just ignore it and suppress it. It's just such a heavy feeling, you know. And I learned personally that when you open yourself up to learn more, that feeling just, it lightens you so much, and it becomes exciting because you're learning more, and it's always a good thing when you start to understand yourself better about who you are and, you know, where you came from.
Yeah. Well, and what kinds of things, how did that work in terms of, you know, you went to school, you obviously had an inkling that was something you wanted to delve into when you were at UWM?
Honestly, so I went to METC, got my 2-year degree. At that time, I was going to be a graphic designer, and, you know, I kind of really got bored with that. It took me a while to figure out where my dust was going to settle, you know, in life, you know. So, but when I finished there, I was like, why not go to UWM and get my bachelor's? So I filled out all the paperwork and on my application, and I just out of habit checked the, you know, Native American on the, you know, the little questionnaire thing. And then as I was getting accepted to UWM, I got a letter from the guidance counselor, and they said, hey, you're a Native student, so you have a special office with Indigenous counselors and everything. And so I was like, okay. And, you know, I have to go meet with her. And Diane was her name, and she was working in the office, and she started talking to me, and, you know, and she's like, oh, you want to take Spanish? Why do you want to take Spanish? You got to take Ojibwe, you know, you got to take Ojibwe, you got to try it. And I was like, okay, I'll try it. And then she was like, oh, what about this class? Oh, you should try this class. And at that time, I wanted to be a writer. That was sort of where my mind was at. And I was like, okay, I'm going to be a writer and take some English classes. And, you know, she talked me into taking, you know, we have these Indigenous Native American literature classes. And I was like, okay, I'll take that. And, you know, and so all of this kind of circled into meeting one person, Meg Noden, who is, she's the director of the Electroquin Institute at UWM, and also the director of the American Indian Studies program. And she is someone so responsible in helping me reconnect to who I am. You know, she had the same sort of struggle growing up and trying to figure out her culture. And so she kind of took me under her wing and always asked me this question. You know, she said, you're learning all of this, and that's great, but what are you going to do with it when you leave? You know, what are you going to use all of this knowledge for to help your people? And that just, you know, that hit me hard, just stuck with me. And, you know, and as I was, like I said, as I was kind of discovering food at the same time, all, you know, this all swirled together, like, what am I going to do for my people? I love food. How am I going to use food to help my people? And, you know, so it's just the circle that you start going around, and then you just, all these ideas that maybe this, maybe that. And it was at that time that Medium really was my idea. Like this is all everything I'm doing right now results from those moments where I was just kind of connecting everything and discovering everything, and it just boom, I want to do this. And so that was the beginning of the journey.
So how did that journey end up progressing? I mean, you obviously were cooking in Milwaukee, you know, for quite a number of years.
And yeah. Then, well, what had happened, and what is, it was always kind of my big flaw, is that I pick up on things very quickly. but I get bored with things very easily. And
when that sounds like a very chef thing. So, I mean, this is why creativity in the kitchen. You know, like why, you know, menus change.
Oh yeah, absolutely, you know, absolutely.
And folks, you know, and folks move on to different positions all the time. You know, I think that's part of
yeah.
The,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, and there was, there, you know, there's that obvious decision you have to make when you enter the food industry, especially when you intend to be a chef. And that's do I just get into the restaurant and just start, you know, busting my rear end? Or do I go to a Le Cordon Bleu or, you know, some kind of CIA school to, you know, get a formal education on food? And at that time, I was okay, I'm done with school. You know, I've been in school long enough. So I just, you know, like I said, I just dove into it to try to learn as much as I can. But I knew that I was way behind for what I wanted to achieve. I was years behind. And so while I was at Odd Duck, I was also working at Circa 1880 and, you know, over at Buckley's and, you know, just, working as many places and as many hours as I can, you know, staging, you know, left and right at, you know, every place in Milwaukee that let me into their doors, because I needed to learn how to run the restaurant, how to build menus. And, you know, it's just sort of my crash course that I turned it into. And Milwaukee's not that big. So eventually you have to kind of take off and, you know, try to go to other places. So, you know, I think what a lot of chefs do is I just took off out west, you know, ended up in San Francisco and, you know, diving into that food scene. And, you know, I got lucky enough to work for Dominique Caren.
That's really, really amazing.
yeah. And that's really where, you know, if you look at the Mijum project, you know, that French influence, you know, that's obviously, that's something that's really stuck inside of me, you know, being able to learn to make such beautiful food, you know, from the Brittany area, region of France. And it just, you know, very lucky, I would say. and then, you know, life gets crazy. So, you know, I ended up kind of all over the place. I ended up in Chicago for a little bit and, you know, just, you know, working at different places. You know, I've got to, you know, spend time at North Pond and then I unfortunately spent some time in Alinea, which is like the worst experience I've ever had.
Oh, no.
Really? How, why was that?
You might be able to tell just by talking to me that I'm not a very macho aggressive person. And, the kitchens like that at that level, it's very intense and you just have, you know, people in your face, you know, you're not going fast enough. You're not doing it clean enough. You know, there's literally, if you shut your cooler door too loud, you're going to have someone up your butt. Just, you know, this is a linear, this is not how we do this. This is, you know, and they're telling you how worthless you are. And, you know, it's just, you know, every.
That's very old school.
Yeah.
Militant. Yeah.
Every like intense kitchen you see on TV or in a movie, that's, you know, it's basically what that is. So,
yeah. The stereotype of aggro restaurant culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a good thing for me. It's actually, I turned it into a wonderful experience because I learned exactly how I don't want to run a kitchen. You know, that's, you know, it's, you know, the culture that I build with my team is it's about trust and respect and, you know, just honest. We're here to do something awesome and let's go for it. You know, that's, yeah. You know, I just want everyone excited to come in and, you know, keep their, you know, just sort of check life's problems at the door and come in and just work on something that they can be passionate about.
So. It does seem like there is a movement towards, or maybe this kind of, cause like many things that happened during the pandemic and, it did seem like there was a move towards, you know, this aggro culture in restaurants. It cannot, it's not sustainable. Like it's not, we can't keep, and I think maybe part of the Anthony Bourdain death spurred a lot of this too, of like, we have to get toxicity out of the restaurant culture, and that includes, you know, work hours. That includes the, you know, the hyper masculine, you know, crappy attitudes in the kitchens. Is that still moving towards progress and moving towards trying to make things better, or have you seen that kind of regress back to the way things were?
No, I've seen incredible progress with
that's awesome.
Pulling away from that culture. You know, I do it for personal reasons. You know, about all the time that I've spent in these very intense kitchens where you're the bottom scum. You know, it affects you mentally in very hard
That's
ways.
Sure.
And, you know, so, I suffer from a lot of, you know, depression, anxiety, you know, insomnia, those things as a result of working in these types of kitchens. And, so for me, it's a personal, it's my responsibility to make sure that I never have that kind of culture in a workplace that I'm responsible for or that I'm involved with.
Yeah. And mental health is important to the job, right?
Well, 100%.
And feeling empowered to actually excel at what you're doing.
Well, to sustain the restaurant industry for that matter, I mean, how do you expect to have, you know, the next generation of restaurant owners and chefs and stuff like that if you just burn everyone out when they're line cooks and stuff like that, when it's not sustainable as an industry in a micro and macro stance.
Well, and it's interesting to me, and kind of just on a side note, you know, that we have this thing called hospitality, you know, and that is very much like opposed. You know, I was going to say it's very, very strange. You know, to have one sort of culture in the kitchen, you know, and then everything redirects toward hospitality, you know, in the dining room.
Such comfort outside the kitchen.
Yeah.
The opposite.
And those two things have been needing to be, you know, dovetailed together, you know, for a while. So, I'm convinced that every single person who rejects that culture, you know, and moves forward with a more empowering, you know, trusting environment is doing a world of good, you know, because every kitchen, you know, moves that forward. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's food, you know, it's always can be art. It can always be, you know, whatever you want to see it as. But when you think about it, we're just making food. Like, I mean, we're just feeding people and, you know, to put it bluntly, we're just keeping plumbers busy. You know, it's just, that's all we're doing. It's just these moments of, you know, tasting and these experiences with, you know, it shouldn't be taken so seriously that it's affecting people's lives. You know, it should be fun and exciting for everyone, front of house, back of a house, sitting at the table. And, you know, and if it's not, then it's just what's the point of eating there? What's the point of working there? What's the point of it existing other than just to help make someone rich, you know? And I just, you know, I'm very against that. That's 100% the mission is to combat that mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we were kind of talking about your trajectory. And one of the things that ended up happening is that you worked with Sean, the sous chef, in Minnesota, kind of, and maybe I've skipped over some things, so you can kind of trace my steps. But I know, you know, that there've been a lot of initiatives, you know, of late, probably in the past decade, you know, that have kind of sprung up. With very similar goals to, I think, what you're going for.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so when I was talking, you know, I'm talking about, you know, kind of all this discovery that I had and, you know, creating, you know, the idea of wanting to do, you know, it's the same time when, you know, Sean's book came out and, you know, he kind of put himself on the map as an indigenous chef. And, you know, so he's always influenced me in a lot of ways. You know, I've always been really excited and happy to see the work that he was doing. And, you know, and as I moved around and, you know, working here, working there, you know, I was lucky to do some events with his team and, you know, kind of see what they're working on. And so as timeline moved forward, 2020, you know, obviously hit and for chefs in the industry, the food industry in total, it's just, you know, as everyone knows, it's devastated. And I was lucky enough to find some, you know, some hours working with Jacobs over at, you know, Fauntleroy and Dan, and, you know, just hang out with a lot of people I haven't seen for a while. And it was a lot of fun, but, you know, the way things worked, you know, with all the closings and everything, I found myself, you know, just on the couch a lot and, you know, getting depressed and everything. And, you know, I sort of, I lost heart and the passion of like the project that I wanted to do, you know, like pre 2020, I had a lot of pop-ups planned around Milwaukee and, you know, I was excited to get Mijim started then, but, you know, they were all canceled. And that, you know, that just left me just, you know, wondering what am I doing? And, luckily, Sean, with his nonprofit, the Natives, Native American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems, they were looking for an executive chef. And, you know, it was a shot in the dark, I thought. But I sent my resume and they called me in, and it was just wonderful. And I fell in love with it immediately and what they were doing. And so I packed up, moved to Minneapolis, and, you know, just, it was very intense.
And this is part of the Indigenous Food Lab. Yeah.
Correct. So, yeah. Kind of break it down. So you have the sous chef. We always saw the sous chef as that's the for-profit side. That's the catering side. That's the, you know, Owamni side. On the other side, the nonprofit, that's Natives, which is, you know, the head organization, you know. So you have Natives, and Natives's big project is the Indigenous Food Lab. And so that's what I was the executive chef of, was the Indigenous Food Lab. And that's, you know, responsible for very intense hunger relief. You know, the kitchen itself was only 8 blocks away from where George Floyd was murdered. You know, the whole area, buildings were just torn down, burned down, just devastated, you know, when I first showed up. And so there's a lot of people displaced, a lot of people homeless, a lot of people starving. And so that's what the Indigenous Food Lab was all about. It was creating indigenous meals, 100% indigenous, no flour, no milk, no soy, no beef, chicken, or pork. It's just, you know, it's all indigenous, and providing these meals to, you know, homeless encampments, to reservations, anywhere that we could find that was in need of really good, nutritious food. You know, we were just on it. You know, in a 3-month period, we were just shy of 100,000 meals that we put out. You know, so very fun, very intense kitchen there, but it was everyone there was just so passionate about what we were doing because they knew that it was making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's standing. And it's interesting because that intersects with, I think, one of the things about most indigenous cooking is that food is not just food, you know, food is medicine, food is, you know, food is nourishment, but food is also, you know, what you use to keep yourself, you know, healthy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we put medicine in everything, you know, traditional medicines like cedar, sage, sweetgrass, you know, those are very traditional to us, but it's also, We have people from the reservation that are beautiful foragers, and they know the medicines that are going to have so much flavor and everything. And so we're fortunate enough to be in an area with such, we have a lot of microclimates, because of, you know, our position with the lake. And so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of things you wouldn't expect up here. You know, the mushrooms alone, you know, just chanterelles and black trumpets just everywhere. You go to the golf courses and they're just, you know, growing everywhere. And so it's just, it's exciting because when you come up here and, you know, if you're, you know, if we're lucky enough to have you guys ever dine with us, you're eating a piece of the area, eating a piece of the land, you know, or, you know, the sky and, you know, or the lake. And it's just, it does heal you. It heals you in, you know, more than just physical ways. It's emotional. It's, you know, mental. And, you know, it helps you just see the world differently, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, and it's about perspective too, you know, just the exercise of thinking about where things come from. And I think foraging is particularly special that way because it doesn't have the complications of agriculture, you know, and what's going on, you know, in raising that food. You know, these are things that are naturally kind of part of the landscape, and, you know, being responsible with them in terms of harvesting is important. But it's also, you know, not food that, you know, people necessarily created. You know, they're things that have been there that people learn to use.
And that's I wish more people could just look at the ground and say, hey, I can eat this, you know, I don't need to go to the drive-thru, you know, maybe I'll just, you know, try this. And, you know, it's, if people did that more, I think that one, there would be a lot less grass, you know, there'd be a lot more people just letting their, you know, the land they have become edible, you know, which makes a lot more sense. But, you know, I think it would also just, if anything, help people just think about where their food's coming from before they purchase it, you know, and instead of going to Walmart and you don't know which country the meat is coming from, you know, people just try to stay local and try to stay small and, you know, maybe pay the extra dollar a pound, you know, for meat that was raised half a mile down the road. You know, if people just get a chance to think that way, it would change everything. Mm-hmm.
And how does this kind of, I know you talked about Mijim being, you know, simple, you know, simple food. But I do think that the way that food has grown up, not all restaurant food is simple, you know, and it might need more explanation, you know, than you might expect, you know, in terms of that. So what should guests expect? Kind of what's the thinking there? You know, how will it work to tell the story? You know, is the food speaking for itself? Are there stories that come along with that? How?
So that's the food will always speak for itself. That's what we want to do is make sure. When I said it's going to be very simple, I sort of meant that we're going to highlight the simple things, but there's going to be a lot of complication in the dish. I guess I don't know if that's the right word.
Complexity, maybe.
Yeah, complexity. Yeah, exactly. It's going to seem simple, and it's a very simple idea and a very simple concept, very approachable. But at the same time, as soon as you take a bite, you're going to realize that there's more depth to it than what you might have expected. And so while that's speaking for itself, we also have been very fortunate enough to, so far, we're still hiring. So if anyone's interested in moving 6 hours away, just, you know, give us a call. But but we so far have hired an entirely indigenous staff, you know, which is, I couldn't have, you know, hoped for better. You know, it's just really incredible that there's just much interest. You know, we welcome any and all people. You know, that's what we're all about. But so far we've just had a very strong response from the indigenous community, and I'm so thankful for that. with the food, you're going to have people who have a spiritual and cultural connection with the food, bringing to your table and being able to, you know, share their perspective or, you know, a little bit of themselves in sort of the explanation of the food, you know, because things will have to be explained. It's just, there's a lot of things that people just never heard of, you know, and my sort of take on food has always been to give something very approachable, very comfortable to someone. But there's going to be something strange in there, a little something that you're going to have to learn about. You know, it's not going to just be that straightforward. You know, it's so there's going to be a lot of conversations in the dining room, and that's what we want. We want people engaged. We want people asking questions because we want people leaving having learned something, you know, about the food or us as people. And you know, that's the underlying problem. You know, it's just, if people come in and they dine with us and they learn something, and then they have a different perspective and they have a better understanding of us, then that creates sort of less of a barrier and less, less racism, less hatred. You know, if we can all have more understanding of other people and their cultures, you're not going to just have these preconceptions of, you know, that they're that you hate them, you know. And so
that really stem from like that fear of the unknown, right?
Exactly.
It's the more you know, the more curious you are, usually. You know, like, it piques your interest. And you know, the minute you start learning more of something, it's pretty hard, you know, not to despise, unless it's an awful thing, right? Like, but something like that. And usually when it comes to culture, you know, the more interested you get, no matter whose culture it is, you know, the more that it breaks down all the boundaries, you know, and you're like, oh, like, that's cool. You know, that's.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, and that's, you know, we're a simple restaurant, but I think there's a lot of big things that, can be helped through it. You know, there's you know, like we're talking about the understanding and everything. Most of the people who come up here during the tourist season are coming from, you know, Minneapolis suburbs, and, you know, they're not always the most educated about the indigenous culture in the area. And, you know, but there's also a strong hunger to actually learn more about it, you know? And so that's something where we can kind of fit in and help with that. You know, that's just, you know, maybe just through food and conversation, but you know, it's probably going to change the way you think, you know?
Yeah. What are some of those kind of, you talked about, you know, unexpected things or surprising things that, you know, diners may not know about. What are some of those offhand? Obviously, I don't want you to give away everything. We want people to go to the restaurant.
But ingredient, but ingredients wise, I'm sure that some of those, maybe you can pick a couple to talk about.
Reveal. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some of those things you're excited to reveal or to expose people to?
Obviously, game meats are going to be a lot of the big things. You know, there's going to be a lot. We're only going to do, you know, wild proteins that, you know, that some people may not just be familiar, you know, elk, and, you know, like there's, we will have, you know, like beaver pemmican and things like that people are just, I don't know if I want to try that, you know, but, you know, maybe be surprised by it. But there's also, the forage ingredients, like we had talked about, you know, there's always going to be, you know, things that people just, you know, they're not familiar with, you know, foraged menus or things like that. They're going to be very surprised by it. But another big thing is corn culture. Mijim is going to be very big on corn culture with nixtamalization and, you know, grinding down to our own masas for, you know, to celebrate different indigenous cultures in the South and the Southwest and, you know, things like that. But it's going to be, there's going to be, I think, a lot of complexity in certain things, that those sometimes are going to be the, you know, sort of the, oh, what is, you know, what's up with this? And, you know, why is this like that? You know, we have, you know, fermentation and, you know, a lot of preservation methods that we're going to be using, because, you know, when we get the good stuff, you know, we want to make sure that we can get as much as we can and save as much as we can, so that, you know, we can have a nice larder getting through the end of the season and things like that. So and honestly, and I think the biggest highlight is that we're not working with, you know, with Sysco or US Foods or, you know, big companies like that. You know, we're working with actual farmers, you know, actual, you know, rabbit farmers and, you know, duck farmers, and, you know, we're getting all of our proteins from small farms and people who we know and we can trust that we're getting the best product that they can provide for us. So,
hell yes. Absolutely. And are there any kind of techniques that you're excited to kind of, like, cooking techniques and things of that nature that you're excited to be like, I don't think people have seen this kind of way of approaching? Like, are there any kind of on the technical side of things that you're excited?
We're trying to keep it very simple, I guess. You know, the techniques are really going to be very French in their roots. You know, there's gonna be a lot of braising, and, you know, there's gonna be a lot of we will be grilling. We do have a Conroe grill, so we're going to be doing a lot of, you know, a lot of charred ingredients and things like that, and, you know, so a lot of sauces, you know, for example, the, you know, like one of the things we're gonna be doing is like a chaga mole, and, you know, it is a mole that's very Oaxacan in style, but at the same time, it's, you know, features very indigenous, you know, ingredients of from the north and, you know, sort of the prairie land. So we got a lot of bergamot and, you know, chamomile and you know, just obviously chaga, things like that, different, you know, dried forage mushrooms, and, you know, we're trying to take, you know, familiar things and then put our indigenous perspective on it, you know, and, you know, sort of, I think, surprise people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and surprising folks. I mean, that's one of the elements I think people look for now, you know, in a restaurant experience is, you know, just, I mean, I don't know how many people will say, oh, I want to learn something, you know, but I think ultimately, you know, the best restaurant meals, you come away with something you didn't have before.
Absolutely. You know. Absolutely. You know, it's, there's only a few dining experiences that I can actually remember, like, very clearly, you know, and because they were meals that they changed how I looked at things, or, you know, I learned something that, you know, I'll never be able to forget, you know, things like that. So, you know, still one of the best meals in my life that I've ever had was with some friends at Wolf Peach, you know, and, you know, that was sort of at Wolf Peach's prime, and
rest in peace, Wolf Peach.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, really, really in their height, and it was just, to me, at that time, in my perspective, it was the perfect meal, and I'll always remember it. You know, and, you know, same way I'll remember, you know, first time I ate a hot duck, and, you know, wanting to work there so bad because everyone looked so cool. You know, you know, and so if I can provide that for even one person with Mijim, I mean, that's, you know, I've accomplished what I'm looking to do.
Yeah. Talk just a little bit about the restaurant where you're opening, you know, because I'm sure there's all sorts of questions, like, how does an opportunity like this come along? And the fact is, you're in a space which was previously used as a restaurant. But I think you were telling me that obviously the concept will change, and that you're preparing this for use as kind of an incubator.
Absolutely.
You can get on, kind of touch on that.
So I think having great people in your life is very important. and Lauren and Gip, they are the owners of the farmhouse, farmhouse and inn. They have a motel right next door to us, which is awesome. They ran brunch out of the farmhouse for I don't remember how many years it's been now, 7 or 8. And I spent a season even working with them, you know, just making brunch and hanging out with them. And that's how we became really good friends. And as 2020 hit, you know, the great 2020, their brunch operation sort of obviously had to scale down. They're doing window service and, you know, just trying to keep up with that. But they started catering, and that's sort of where, you know, that got really popular, just because it was easier to just, you know, people stay at home. And so they got really deep into catering and realized that they liked it a lot, and they weren't using the farmhouse, they weren't utilizing it all the way. And, you know, so when I moved back up here and I'm looking around trying to find spaces for rent or sale, you know, nothing up here. It's crazy, because it is a small area, and there's a lot of bars and restaurants that have been open, you know, for, I remember them as a little kid, you know, so it's just sort of that no one's moving. Exactly. And so I kept thinking about Madeline Island, and, you know, maybe I can do something, you know, like out of a yurt for the summer, you know, like just kind of something for fun. But I went over there to see Gip and Lauren and see how things are going at the farmhouse, and they kind of told me, and I just like asked them, like, can I open, you know, Mijum? And they're just like, okay, yeah, sure. Like, you know, it's just that quick. They're like, oh yeah, that would be cool if you did that. And, you know, it was like, oh my god, this is a dream come true. And, you know, so we're really happy about it. But then they go, oh, by the way, we have some maintenance stuff that we might have to take care of, and which turned out to be, you know, rotted floors from leaking ice makers and, you know, things like that. And so, you know, I ended up with a very large handful of projects that I had to take care of, you know, right away. And, you know, it's been taking up so much of my time. I'm still working on them. You know, trying to get the space as wonderful as possible for people to come in. You know, we sort of went a little bit beyond what we needed to do to try to, you know, maximize the space, make it the most comfortable and have the best flow, you know? So, sort of that bittersweet, you know, I just wanted to get into the kitchen to start recipe testing and cook, and, you know, but, you know, I'm still got a hammer in my hand and, you know, trying to get it all together. But we're so close. We really are so close. And the space, I just think of, like, you know, any Cape Cod in Milwaukee, you know, just like a very, you know, basic kind of like the Peter Griffin's house on Family Guy. It just looks exactly like that. But that's what Mijum is. It's just a Cape Cod style home that was converted into a restaurant. And so that's the atmosphere we wanted when people come in, is to make them feel, you know, that like they're guests, you know, at our house, you know, very comfortable, very, you know, there's gonna be, you know, maybe almost too loud of music, you know, just, you know, there's going to be a good tempo going on in there, but at the same time, it's good, hopefully have a really good energy and just make people feel like they're just hanging out at, you know, at a party, and they're eating great food. You know, that's the goal. You know, we'll see if that's what it turns out to be when all is said and done, but, you know, that's what we hope for people to have that experience when they come.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And as far as, like, you were, I think you expressed to me that this probably won't be Imagem's forever home. You know, that this is sort of like part of this incubator sort of concept. And, like, are you holding some hope that the space will be able to incubate other Native concepts?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, as I'm kind of tearing stuff out and rebuilding it, you know, I'm realizing that this is just a really great space, and it was never going to be, you know, a permanent space for Mijum. You know, I knew that right away, because I have a very specific concept in my head on what the final Mijim will be, and you know, to be a full build out, and you know, it's very excited about it. But so we're hoping, you know, spend a couple seasons, you know, at the farmhouse Mijim space, and hoping to get a good following, you know, get people kind of somewhat of a name recognition, so that, you know, as I guess collateral, you know, to try to, you know, get a good loan and, you know, build out the big space and everything like that. So when we leave, I know that Gip and Lauren, they're just done with restaurant. They don't want anything to do with it. And so we start talking, and, you know, it'd be great, you know, if once we leave, the space is just perfectly ready for someone to just come in and, you know, just put their mark on it, you know. And absolutely, I hope that, you know, someone who's indigenous, who wants to start, you know, another indigenous restaurant, you know, that's something that, unlike other chefs, I know they fear competition and, you know, it becomes a big thing, but I welcome it. I welcome that, you know, that collaboration of, oh, what are you guys doing? Cool. This is what we're doing. And, you know, I think that I get that from sort of the Milwaukee spirit. You know, that's how Milwaukee chefs are. They're always just so close knit and, you know, sharing so much. And I've always loved that. And, you know, so that's something that I welcome up here, and I hope that happens, because truth be told, the food is terrible up here. I mean, it's a you know, it's a tourist destination, so you're just getting quick food. You're getting hamburgers and potato chips, and you know, just that really quick, you know, what can we make that's cheap and you know,
that appeals to everybody, right? Yeah, across the board. Appeals.
Exactly. Yeah. There's like 12 pizza places up here in this very small area, and it's ridiculous. And so, you know, I hope that what we're doing is maybe someone else is going to see that as like, oh, we need to step up, you know, mm-hmm. we need to, you know, try to work with local farmers more, because, you know, that's what people want, and, you know, mm-hmm. things like that. And I hope that happens. I really do. I want, you know, I want a food renaissance up here, and, you know, mm-hmm. if I can do anything to help spark that, I'm going to do it.
So you're pretty close. Pretty close to opening. Are you still is May 24th still a viable date?
So May 25th was the 25th. Official.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's the official opening. So mm-hmm. 25 days from now. I still have bear studs on the wall. You know, we're going to get there. So that's the, you know, official opening. We do have a soft opening for friends and family on the 20th. Why we decided to do that, I don't know. But so that gives us 20 days to at least make it, you know, a space that people can actually dine in, and, you know, mm-hmm. actually get our staff in for training and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's really close. We're super nervous, freaking out a little bit, but we're, you know, we're keeping it all together.
That's called opening a restaurant.
Yeah. So no, we're very excited. We're extremely excited. I just can't wait for people to, you know, come and, you know, just let me know what they think. You know,
Yeah. Well, and things like this end up being an evolution, right? I mean, you start one way and concepts are shaped by, you know, by not only you, you know, but by the people who are there. And, you know, it's like you describe like what you think it might be like. And, you know, then you get people in the space and it's something slightly different, you know. And so there's always got to be room for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, at its base, at its foundation, you know, Mijim is a thing, you know, and that won't change. But sort of how it looks or feels.
Might. Yeah, an obvious nod to Odd Duck. And it's just a byproduct of working with these types of ingredients, but our menu will change constantly. It'll constantly evolve. You know, that's why the small plate concept works so well, is because you can keep rotating and rotating, you know, as the seasons change. But also, you know, we're working with a lot of new and interesting flavors, a lot of proteins that people haven't tried, or, you know, things like that. And so when it's served up in smaller portions and you can just, you know, try it. Ooh, I don't like that, or I do like that. You're not committed to
to
the big entree. Yeah, so you know it's just, you know, and again, that's creating more conversation. It's just, you know, what do you think of that, or what is that? And then, you know, it's a constant conversation about food and about, you know, the culture. And so that's, you know, it just comes together really beautifully, I think.
Yeah. So will this be seasonal?
It will for now. The whole area up here is seasonal.
Very much like Door County. You're probably checking like May through November or October.
We have October. We have Apple Fest up here, which if you've never been, I recommend it. It's nice. Huge festival that usually attracts like 60,000 to 70,000 people over the weekend. It's ridiculous in a town of 400. But yeah, so that kind of Apple Fest, which is in October, somewhat symbolizes the end of the season. But really, it gets, you know, right into November is when everyone just starts shutting down. And then, you know, it's just a dead winter, you know, where it's just everything's closed all winter. But I hope my goal long term is that we can create a space that's interesting enough to attract people all year long, to where they'll be willing to come out to dine with us, even in the dead of winter, you know, to try to make it an experience, because I think during the winter we could have such a beautiful menu, you know, and if we're able to share that with people, that would be great.
Yeah. Cool.
Absolutely.
Can people act?
The most important. I was going to ask our most important question.
And your question actually dovetails mine. So go right ahead.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Well, then in that case, our very important question: where can people find out more about everything you're doing? Where can people, what websites, what social media?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have social media. We have Instagram and Facebook. Instagram's handle is Mijim with like an underscore after. It's MIIJIM is how it's spelled. Otherwise, you can go to Mijim.com. You know, go to our website. Through there, you can book a table with Rezi. We have a sample menu just to give some ideas of flavors. And then we also have, you know, a little more in-depth information about what we're doing and what the project is.
Yeah. And the address and all those very important
things. All the
details. Yeah, no, I was going to ask about reservations because I thought I remembered, you know, that people can actually make them. So if they know they're taking a trip to the north already, to the Northwoods, you know, that's, I mean, you're probably, I'm just trying to think. So how far are you from, I mean, there's not a lot of like metropolises, you know, in the area, but I'm trying to think, you know, Duluth.
So Duluth is Superior and Duluth. If we got to go to the big city, you know, that's where we're going.
Yes.
And, you know, so we are about, let's say, just over an hour east from Duluth. Just if you literally just follow along the lake, you know, you'll come right to Bayfield. And so Bayfield is really where everyone has to go. That's at the top of the peninsula, but that's where you get on the ferry to get over to Madeline Island. You know, so if you don't have a boat, you're forced to take the ferry, you know.
Yes, and the ferry ride is probably how long?
Oh, it's less than half an hour. It's not that far, you know. And it's really, if you've never been on, you know, a ferry or up in this area, it's really beautiful, you know, just watching, you know, you see all the other islands and you're just kind of, you know, I don't know. It's just really fun. I have to take it every day right now because, you know, they're not launching boats yet, but, you know, it's a fun experience when you do it once in a while, but every day it gets tiring.
So, well, it just becomes transportation, right?
Like, oh yeah, yeah. It's just time. It's public transportation, you know. So it's just, you know, it's just a part of it, you know. And I think having to take the ferry to get out to dine with us, I think is just it's another part of the experience, you know, just sort of
you can bond with it. You can bond with Lake Superior a little bit, you know, before you get to the island. Right?
Absolutely. And luckily, if you're sitting on our patio, you know, you're just looking at the water. You know, we're right on the lake, just unfortunately across the street, not on the lakeside, but you know, you still see the beautiful lake and, you know, the ferry dock and everything, just, you know, if you're dining with us. So it's, you know, it's a beautiful setting that I couldn't have asked for a better place to, you know, open up and, you know, get started with.
Well, thank you. Awesome. Thank you for coming on and so sharing. This is definitely one of those, you know, things that I don't know. I love it that there are these burgeoning like cultural connections coming forward through food in particular, you know, because I don't know. I think food works. Food works to introduce people to things that they might not otherwise, you know, be.
Yeah, it's
naturally interested in, right?
Yep.
it brings people together, you know.
Yeah, it's a beautiful medium, and honestly, it's I don't know if you want me to get into another anecdote, but my wife is Italian, you know, and when I first started dating her, her grandparents got, you know, sort of sick, and so we moved in with them, and they're obviously Italian, and you know, her grandma, the food she would make, you know, she's well into her 80s, and she's, you know, making pasta by hand, and you know, just stewing for hours, and you know, so she started teaching me how to cook, because you know, at the time, Jess, my wife, wasn't really, she wasn't interested, you know. She's like, I ate this food all my life. I don't, you know, but I was so excited about it. I never had it. And so she started teaching me. And that honestly was the first time that I cooked with good, real ingredients, made something from scratch. You know, it wasn't from a can. It wasn't from a package, you know, which is how I grew up. But this was, I mean, she was, everything was from scratch. And it was just really beautiful, you know. It was beautiful learning that, and then I discovered like her whole family through that food are connected in a way that like I don't think I'll ever properly get to experience. And it's just like, even now when she, you know, her grandparents passed, but even now when Jess is biting into something that, you know, maybe an Italian cookie that she had growing up, it's just like all this emotion, and she's just, you know, just all swims back to her, and it's just from that one bite, that one taste, that one flavor. And you know, it's just so exciting.
I don't think
to see
anyone
that
is connected to their food quite like Italians.
Like, honestly
to be fair,
I mean, you know, we honeymooned in Italy, like in the town where her family's from, and mm-hmm. I mean, just I just thought her grandma was special, and this was just like, you know, a one-off thing, but everyone there, that's just how it is. And the food is just, you know, it there's no junk in it, and they just take such pride in it. And, you know, I love it. You know, so that, you know, I always feel like there's a little bit of Italian in me from that, just, you know, from, you know, getting to learn that spirit of just how important it is for your family and for your connections with people. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Well, and food does do that. So I think that's a cool first experience for you, you know, and probably gives you a semblance of a thought as to how you can do that, you know, for other people, even if it's not something, you know, you've had since childhood.
And, you know, it's just because you unfortunately miss out on something doesn't mean you can't change that experience for someone else. And, you know,
right.
Just give them that chance to, you know, have those connections.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's call it a podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Gitche Miigwetchen, which means, you know, big thanks to you. So,
what a fascinating conversation. Just a fascinating human being as well. Just a lot of really interesting stuff to talk about there. Food. It's such a great topic.
Yes, it is, because everybody can connect to it in some sort of way, and it connects us all, like, in ways that I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that there's way more to say than you can cover in one podcast with regard to Midgem. But I'm really excited that we have someone doing this in Wisconsin.
Yeah, because
I'm not aware.
I know Molly wrote a piece, a review of the
Mamwe.
In Minnesota. And she had a really wonderful time there. Really great food, great experience. And it's awesome that Wisconsin is going to have something like that as well now. And hopefully more to come from the sounds of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this has been bubbling up for a while. And like anything, I mean, it's sort of like you think about how, you know, Filipino culture has been kind of has had a surge in terms of, you know, younger people wanting to, you know, especially in the U.S., you know, wanting to take hold of what their cultural and culinary background is, you know, and share it with other people. And I think that the same thing is happening with something that is much more difficult to wrap your head around. And that's, you know, any sort of Native American heritage, because it has been really, you know, cloaked in history.
Yeah.
You know, for so long. Yeah. I'm really, really excited.
Yes. Now for something admittedly less exciting. We have we don't normally do actual serious announcements at the end of this podcast. Normally it's just us farting around for 5 minutes and we go on to telling people our Twitter handles and then moving on. We do have a bittersweet announcement to make. We are going to go on a bit of a hiatus for the
summer. A summer break.
Food Crush is going to be closed for the season.
Yeah.
Our hours are going down. We hope to be back.
Yeah.
We're just going to kind of refresh, re-cleanse, you know, get our minds right, and hopefully come back with a version of Food Crush that's even better
than the first time. You know, we've been doing this for...
Gotta be close to 200 episodes.
You know, and quite nearly for I think we're at 172 or 173.
Yeah.
It's been 4 years, you know, since we launched this in October of 2018. And aside from a short break where we had to figure out what we were doing during the pandemic, you know, we've been pretty much going strong a few times a month for 4 years. That's incredible.
Yeah.
It's
incredible that you've been listening to us, you know, this whole time through, and we appreciate you all so much for listening.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's sticking around and listening when Food Crush 2.0 makes it sound odd, but like,
yeah,
Food Crush back from summer vacation, you know, comes back.
If you've been listening this whole way and you've listened through all of the episodes, like, I mean, A, number one, kudos to you, because you are loyal and beloved. If you are newer to the podcast, we are going to be rerunning podcast episodes. You know, we have 170 of them all throughout the summer. So it gives us a chance to take a breather and do some evaluation. It also gives you a chance to catch up, which would be really hard to do with a shorter break. So, you know, there's some good that could come. And you can keep watching on the Food Crush channels, particularly, I think, on Instagram. We'll be shooting out some throwback episodes. And, you know, who knows? There might be maybe there'll be some Food Crush Live.
Yeah. We won't disappear. Don't worry.
No.
There will be bad news for people who can't tolerate us. There will be plenty of us to go around still.
And I just can say, I will both still be doing our thing at Milwaukee for sure. So
absolutely,
there will be no lack of food content to read and enjoy.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for listening through this first phase of the podcast, and if you want to find those old episodes that we'll be rerunning, Lori, where can people find the Food Crush podcast on the internets?
You found us at some channel or other, so you can continue to find us here. But we are also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Food Crush Pod. That's our handle. And like I said, we'll be dishing out content there.
Dishing, because food.
Yeah. All summer long.
And for more food content, Lori, where can people find you?
People can find me at Low Frederick on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, as well as at omawaki.com. And how about you, Matt?
Well, you can find me at A Man About Film on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. You can find me there occasionally still talking about food. Occasionally talk about food.
You talk wild, wonderful, crazy food.
Yeah. And I talk about all sorts of things. Listen, there's so much that we do at On the Walkie. No shortage. So we can't wait to do more and to talk more with you all.
Yes. So not really goodbye. But you know.
Definitely not goodbye.
Here's to a pause. You know.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we'll see you on the other side of it. Bye, y'all. Keep cooking for a whole summer.